What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week, and we review them. And I'll just mention, if you want ad-free versions of this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. But
and if you want ads, all ads version, just turn on the TV in the early 90s. Because that's mostly ads.
Or flip to the ads in these comic books, am I right? Boy, it's out of control. It sure is. It really actually is.
I like them. They keep the world spinning, Alex.
Where am I going to find
commercials,
my sea monkeys?
Commercials.
Where am I going to find
Yeah, exactly. I know. The liquid smoke that we brought into my house about 30 years ago and stained the carpet, the brand new carpets in our upstairs bedroom, our parents lost their minds.
Tell you what, that stuff smelled gross, and I loved it.
What a crazy idea. If for any of you that don't know what liquid smoke is, it was something that in the back of comics, it looked awesome. It was like, it looked like you could make smoke come out of your hand. In practice, it was an oil you covered your hands with and then sprayed everywhere. It's a crazy idea.
But great. And we're selling some if you want to check it out. But first, Supergirl number one from DC Comics, written by Sophie Campbell, art by Tamara Bonvillain. This is taking the Maid of Might and bringing her back to her roots with a twist. She gets back home and she finds things are not exactly the way that she expected. Justin, what did you think about this book?
I like this a lot. I think this book has a great team on it. Like, the team is on the same page so hard, I feel like, with this book. It is a very different Supergirl than what we've seen from the Tom King run. Not at all jaded and dark. This is all bright and fun. It feels, we get thought bubbles are very aggressively used here in a way that, like, you're really in her head and there's a mystery here, but it's fun. Crypto looks like a different dog slightly, and I have a question about why is Crypto a different dog?
Remind me, because I wasn't paying as close attention. Crypto looks like he does in the movie, right?
Well, he's got like a yellow tinge to his fur. All right. And like, famously, Crypto is
I kind of feel like DC, and I don't love saying the word editorial mandate, but I think DC has an editorial mandate to do whatever dog you want.
You could do whatever dog?
Yeah, well, why isn't like, a dog I guess a character? The opposite of a mandate. It's more like, you know, just have fun out there. Choose a dog. Yeah. It's all good.
That's a very nitpicky note, but I was struck by the first time we see Crypto. I'm like, that's that Crypto. Did he just go through?
It's just a new Crypto.
Is he eating too many bananas? What's happening?
I also really like this a lot. This, like you said, is very different tonally. It reminded me a little bit of romance comics, which might just be the amount of thought balloons that are going on there. But I thought that was really fun. It comes off like a teen YA book a little bit. So like you said, very different from the Supergirl we've seen, who has been like all war all the time for the past couple of years at this point. This is also, not to contrast this with another run, but there was recently a whole thing with Supergirl and Power Girl, them being like, who are we? We're from other universes. Yes. What's going on with our identity? And I understand that need to talk about Supergirl's identity because it's complicated. I don't think it worked there. It does work here. And it works here because it brings Supergirl back to basics in a way. This is, I think, going to be very comfortable for anybody who is familiar with Supergirl from the CW series. It's not quite as aged up as that, but it has similar, like, very fun continuity bits going on in it. So, yeah, I really enjoyed this a lot. Looking forward to the rest of the run.
And it's able to scoop up a lot of the other continuity that has been sort of swept away over the years and make a little bit sense of it, do some fun things with a very cool comb.
Yes.
Like a comb that really is cool. Yeah.
Yeah, very fun stuff.
But, I mean, the whole issue is about identity in a way because there's another Supergirl in town that is maybe taking her identity, and she seems a little bit fragile in her identity, which I really liked. It feels like that they took a criticism of the character, mm-hmm. and we're able to weave it into the DNA of this new series. And that's really cool. That's hard to do, and it was set out in a really fun way.
Well, let's see if it works two titles in a row, because next up we've got Gwenpool, number one from Marvel, written by Kevin Scott, art by Stefano Nessi. Now, spoiler warning for the whole podcast, but we got to talk specifically about what's going on here, because Marvel several months ago put out what this book is about, which is something that is saved for a last page reveal, but it's out there. It's not a spoiler. Marvel wants you to know to pick up the book. And what they have done is dug up Gwen Stacy and given her Weapon X style Wolverine powers and pitted her against...
I would say Deadpool.
Yeah, Deadpool mixed. She's got claws. She's got like swords coming out of her wrists or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, that's Gwen Stacy. This is the actual Gwen Stacy. And she's coming face to face with Gwenpool, who is in this issue and is dealing with some weird overpowering stuff of her own that is really creeping out Spider-Man, Kate Bishop, and less so. But Jeff the Land Shark is also there. He seems mostly fine with everything.
Well, pretty real side inclusion of Jeff the Land Shark. I was like, oh, a comedy book because Jeff the Shark's in it. And I was like, oh, no. No.
That's not what this is.
Okay.
So very controversial. People very pissed and upset about it for a variety of reasons because they feel very proprietary over Gwen Stacy. Also, for anybody who is confused, Gwenpool is neither Deadpool nor Gwen Stacy. She is a woman named Gwendolyn Poole who comes from the quote-unquote real universe. She was a comic book fan.
I went to high school with her.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, so you're the same age as Gwenpool?
Yeah. She's been lost in the comics for a while. Uh-huh. She's been lost in between the panels.
She ends up in the Marvel Universe and uses that knowledge to figure out how to be a... mercenary was the word that I was looking for, like Deadpool, but over time that has morphed into sort of these continuity warping powers where she can literally walk outside of the comic book page and into other panels, which is on display here. So that's a lot of information up front. Justin, over to you for the weather.
And I would say I liked this sunny day we had here in New York City. So back to you, Alex, to finish the review. No, I liked this book, but to your point, I feel like you need to know so much. Like, this book is on the outer edge of all continuity. Because Gwenpool felt like sort of almost like a joke idea, where they took a character and were like, what do people love about Deadpool? That he can talk to the reader directly and can break the fourth wall in comics. What if there was a character whose whole thing was breaking the fourth wall? That's Gwenpool. That's really all she can do. And they actually are very smart. Kevin Scott does a great job of like using that power to make it an actual power here, which I thought was really cool and innovative. And then to take the actual Gwen Stacy, make her this Weapon X killer, and she kills people in this. I was like, you have to know so much, and you have to be ready to be mad a little bit, or be at least like ready for an aggressive change. And it is also funny because it's sort of like the controversial pivotal moment when in the DC universe, when Batman and Superman both realize their moms are named Martha, and that becomes very important. It's like these two people are like, I'm Gwenpool. Now we have to have a relationship about this. And it feels very constructed from an editorial point of view, but I still enjoyed the story. Mm-hmm. You got to know what you're getting into here, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. Definitely this is an external thing, but knowing about the Gwen Stacy thing going in and then them playing coy about it for an issue, for that to be the last page reveal, I was like... I can't fault the comic book for that, but I can fault the reading experience in terms of, well, I knew this from page one. Maybe we could have gotten into it sooner, because I agree with you. I really like the Gwenpool stuff and all of the sections with her teaming up with Spider-Man, Kate Bishop, and Jeff. Very fun. Fighting Fig Fag Foom. Very fun. Creative. Enjoyable. Weird. Uh-oh, something is wrong with Gwen's powers. They're weirder than usual. Great. All that stuff is great. The Gwen Stacy stuff right now, I don't know why it's there or why it's happening. And I understand that is the function of a second issue. But knowing that going in, I was like, let's get to that because that's the reason you're telling this story, I assume. So I need to know what that is to be hooked in here. That's all.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, this is coming. I mean, Gwen Stacy is a character that, for whatever reason, has become such a let's find a way to twist her into another comic between like Ghost, Spider, and all of that, which I love. And I'm not critical of that. Like, I don't mind. I think she's a good character that Marvel has found a way to like just cram her in wherever possible. Mm-hmm. I will say, so I like I'm here for it. I don't mind it. I don't mind all the complaints everyone's mad about. But if you're a Fin Fang Foom fan, you get like a full monologue here from in something. My guy Finn doesn't really talk much in most comics. He's usually growling or just like being. Well, and big.
I'll also say Stefano Nessi draws the hell out of this. There's a great splash page where he's roaring Godzilla style in the distance that I thought was really cool, and it's there for a really good setup for a joke. So
yeah,
so good job there. Yes, people are going to be mad about this. They are going to be mad about absolutely everything. But I'm very much in a wait and see mode because, like you said, there are parts of this that I certainly enjoy.
That's good. You know, controversial comic, get it to the top of the charts. If it bleeds, it leads.
If it bleeds, it leads. Invincible, speaking of bleeding, Invincible Universe Battle Beast, number one from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Ryan Ottley. Now, this takes place between the pages of Invincible, picking up in Invincible 19, where Battle Beast, after kicking the crap out of Invincible, walked through a portal and left, and then he doesn't show up again until, like, Invincible 53 or something like that. So this is what were his adventures, and as we find out in this issue, it's trying to kill increasingly large and deadly beings throughout the galaxy. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. I know this is like a much, like everyone loves Battle Beast. Mm-hmm. But like, if I can just break down the core of this character, it's an undefeatable, tiger adjacent warrior whose whole thing is like, can someone please kill me? And I will say that's not the most fun walking out the door premise for me.
Yeah.
And that's what happens here. I mean, you know, Robert Kirkman does a good job. Like, this is Kirkman and Ottley, like, great team on this. Does a good job of like adding some other characters and stuff. But the core story, I was hoping we were going to get like, and we get a little backstory here, but an interesting backstory about how Battle Beast became this invincible warrior or something, because it just feels like a maxed out super warrior who is literally undefeatable. Is literally invincible.
Yes, I hear you on that. I think the real draw here is Kirkman and Ottley back in the Invincible universe. Ottley's art is great. Again, not to keep calling out the splash really pages, but there's so many like these quiet splash pages as Battle Beast goes to this alien planet that really broke up the rhythm of the comic, I thought, in an interesting way.
Yeah.
But you touched on this. I think what they are doing here, or at least what I hope they're doing here, is because Battle Beast is this straightforward character to the point that, like, the ship's computer at one point doesn't make fun of him, but he's like, I'm going to tell you that this is a great story about how I decided that I wanted to battle people throughout history. Here we go. Here's my story. And his story is basically like, I battled all these people. My planet was wrecked. And so I left, and then I kept battling people. And it cuts back to the ship's computer being like, oh, I really thought there was going to be more of it. That.
Yeah, and that way the ship's computer, I was like, yes, yeah, you're speaking for me. Here.
So by the end of the book, we have the ship's computer who's like, okay, there's got to be more here. And then there's like this half-dissolved skeleton man who's like, thank you for getting me home. And Battle Beast is like, I'm going to eat you along the way. You're a snack.
Yeah, I'm going to eat you later, like, snack.
So I don't know exactly what they're setting up here, but I do think like having these two other characters are like, oh my God, what is going on here? Potentially leads to some good comedy as it does,
yeah,
I think, in this first issue.
I just, and the table is set for that. I just hope there's some development. And yes. like, you know, these people are like comic legends. I assume there will be. But there isn't a lot of indication in this title, in this issue, that is, that tells us where we're going development-wise.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, they are on it for the long haul. Like, this is not a miniseries. This is a series. So, should be interesting.
This beast gonna battle.
Absolute Batman number 8 from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder, art by Marcos Martin. This is the second part of the Absolute Mr. Freeze arc, and when we last left Bruce Wayne, he had met the monstrous, stretched-out new Mr. Freeze. In this issue, we get a wrap-up of the arc as he deals with Mr. Freeze, and also deals with the memory of Matches Malone.
Yes. This comic is like an art book at this point. It's like... it's just so beautifully done. And I feel like Scott Snyder is doing such a good job of just like is telling a great story, but also leaving so much space for the Dragota art to just shine.
This is Marcos Martin.
Oh, sorry. This is Marcos Martin for the Marcos Martin art to just shine here. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful book to just let wash over you. And we get a lot of different sections here. There's each new sort of movement in the issue is interesting in its own way. The Mr. Freeze, the Absolute Mr. Freeze, is terrifying in a good way. We get great fight sequences here. It's just the Matches Malone of it. Like, it's such a weird thing to make him a different person who is like, we're meant to really care for him. When I'm like, I don't know how much I care for him. I just love this story and the way it's told and the continued mystery here. And then this is the end of this 2-issue arc, getting us to the next one, which I'm equally excited about.
It would have been much funnier if he was a separate person, but also still looked exactly like Bruce Wayne with a mustache and like a little matchstick in his mouth. That's what they should have done. That would have been much better.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Scott is really pushing himself on the layouts in this issue, which, like you're saying, gets the whole art book nature of it. There's a lot of cross-cutting between scenes and contrast between scenes that we've also seen from Nick Dragota, as you mentioned. So, great-looking book. Very excited to see where this goes next. One World Under Doom, number 4 from Marvel, written by Ryan North, art by R.B. Silva. This issue, Dormammu and Doom have not come to bargain. Dormammu has decided that Doom has left the Earth defenseless as the Sorcerer Supreme. And this issue is just one big battle, mano a mano, between Dormammu and Doom as they pull out all their various
mano tricks. A mano against Dormammu.
Dormammu a mano. I don't know.
Dormammu.
Dormammu. We've been a little back and forth on the series of this whole event, but I gotta say, just on the basis of this issue, I think this was the best one so far. So focused, good battle, good focus on Doom that I think we've been really missing. And finally putting all the political stuff, which is just not working, to the side.
Well, that's a little harsher than I would say. Like, it's not that it's not working. It's just that that's moving slowly as a storytelling idea. Everyone's like, this Doom is bad. Let's kill him. And Doom's like, I just made it so everyone can travel everywhere. And, like, I fixed healthcare.
How dare
you? Yeah, the heroes and the writing adjacently need to move past the premise and be like, hey, Doom's doing something different here. And we keep getting little clues, in this issue there's one as well, that there's a secret here behind all of this that we're going to get to that is inherently the villainous part. Mm-hmm. So, but that all aside, like, this issue as a big knockdown dragout fight is awesome. And it's really nice because Doom, the narration is Doom, and he's like, I fucked up. I'm bad at this. Like, because that's the other part about this is this crossover, and especially this title, has made Doom the protagonist. Like, he's the main character. The heroes are out of step with reality. So, like, we are, just from a narrative point of view, riding with Doom in this event so far.
Well, I disagree with that a little bit, and I actually think not to plus it up a little bit, but I think that would have helped if it was more clearly from Doom's perspective from the first issue. And you do have these villains who are attacking him, who are the Avengers and Fantastic Four. That would be great, but we've thus far been getting it from their perspective as they attack him. I think the perspective flip really worked here because we do, to borrow a term from you, get inside of his head.
Yeah, and Dormammu is such a good villain here because you forget how powerful he is because he's always just beat up in the Marvel Universe, or at least for the past decade or so. Like, he's just wrecked constantly. But this issue is like, no, he's actually very powerful, and that's good for Doom to fight someone who is a little bit ahead of him on the Doctor Strangeness of it. And pointing to some weakness, but again, like, now we're like, come on, Doom, beat this bad guy.
Yeah. Dark Regards, number one, from Odie Press, written by Dave Hill, art by Artyom Topalin. We had Dave Hill on the live show this week, so check that out for a chat about the origins of this book. But this is a fictionalized version of the true story about how Dave antagonized a bunch of black metal bands in Scandinavia, and it ultimately almost led to nuclear destruction, kind of, not really, maybe. Regardless. Dark regardless. This is a very fun comedy book that really channels Dave Hill's voice, I think.
Yes. I mean, Dave Hill, like, I don't know, if you don't know Dave Hill, just like Google him. He's a New York mainstay comedian who's had a just wild, interesting life and career. I'm a little biased because I worked with him on a show for many years ago. But great dude. This story is like, I love how it's based in reality, but operates above reality, but also gives you this like fun story about how he did like sort of start pranking these black metal bands, while at the same time giving you like a nice slice of life of being like a New York comedian at the same time. Like, it's a really good comic from a writing perspective. And the art, I think, it really pluses it up and makes it come alive from a like tinges of horror while also getting some of the more slice of life graphic novel stuff that when Dave was on the show, he talked about being a fan of when he was younger. The biggest thing for me from our interview was that Dave drew one of the covers, and he was working to be a comic book artist until he became like successful as a comedy musician. So that's wild.
That is pretty cool. And on the art style, the Artyom Topalin, I love his stuff. He worked with Kyle Starks on a bunch of books. I want to say he did I Hate This Place, but I could be wrong about that. But this seems even more cartoony. It's like, not all the way, but it seems to be channeling Sergio Aragonés a little bit.
Yes, that's a great call.
Very fun. If you're looking for a wild story in comic book form, check this out.
DC High Volume, Batman. The Dark Knight's definitive DC comic stories, adapted directly for audio for the very first time.
Fear. I have to make them afraid.
He's got a motorcycle. Get after him, or I'll have you shot.
You mean blow up the building?
From this moment on, none of you are safe.
New episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Batman Dark Patterns, number 6 from DC Comics, written by Dan Waters, art by Hayden Sherman. The way the series works is you get 3 issues on a case from back in the day, earlier in Batman's career. And this case is a bonkers one because the ventriloquist kind of has taken over an entire apartment building. Last issue, we found out it wasn't the regular ventriloquist at all. It was somebody else who was talking through this apartment building, turning it into one giant Scarface. And we get the conclusion here. Another great arc for this series, I would say.
I mean, having to puppet a whole building, very difficult to get your hand up underneath a whole building.
Yeah. Not if you're Godzilla. I don't want to spoil something later on, but...
Oh, great point.
Do you think he ever does that? Like, picks up 2 buildings? It was like...
I think in the Matthew Broderick movie, he fully puppeted. He was like, oh, he puppeted the Empire State Building, I think, briefly.
Yeah.
It was like Rampage, the video game, except puppets.
That movie has one of my least favorite, most favorite last lines ever, which is Gene Reno is walking away, and Matthew Broderick's girlfriend is like, who was that? And he's like, I don't know, just some French guy. That's great. The last line of the movie. Great movie.
That's one of those movies where you're like, Was anyone paying attention for the whole movie? Like, oh, I feel God. Like people were paying attention at points, but here, that's because that's the one where Godzilla eventually goes underground and is like can fit inside a sewer.
Yeah, that's the one Godzilla lays a bunch of baby Godzilla eggs in Madison Square Garden. And
yeah,
if you ever have a chance, if you've never seen 98 Godzilla, I think it was
something like
right?
that. Yeah.
Go watch the end on YouTube, the final fight as they're escaping from Madison Square Garden, because it is one of the stupidest, worst things you will ever see in your life.
Very stupid.
You know what I thought? You know what I think they probably thought as far as with that movie was the advertising campaign, which was great. I don't know if you remember that, but like they had the buses. Skin was
yes,
like just a
huge.
Tail, and it's like,
yeah,
his tail is as big as this bunch. And you're like, oh shit, this is gonna be awesome. It was not awesome.
No, but also, again, the movie that they wrote down the words was like, his tail's so big, you'll never believe it. He also fits in a regular sewer pipe, you know, where your poop goes. He yep. fits in there too. He crawls through there.
The other big thing about this movie that we shouldn't talk about for very specific current reasons is the soundtrack, which was also great, but we'll leave it at that.
Oh, nice. I don't know what you're talking about, but I will Google it.
Google lead single Godzilla soundtrack, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Kevin Spacey's All-Star Band? Is
that... Close enough. Close enough.
Great. But speaking of this comic, and I don't know if what we just said will fit as a quote on the back of the trade paperback here, but you could probably get pretty close.
DC, wait, hold on. Stop the printers.
You're going to love this book quote from Comic Book Live.
This quote is as big as his stomach.
Yeah, his tail. The this book, this I love the premise of this book in general. It's giving us, like, I've talked about art book before, but, like, we're getting that here. It's nice, like, weirder Batman stories. What I love about this is the Hayden Sherman art is giving us so many different perspectives. Like, Batman's in this building, and we're getting a lot of just, like, the quote-unquote camera is moved around to a lot of different places, which is really cool. The story is weird, but the art is really good. But the big thing I want to credit here is Batman. You get to see Batman do actual detective work in this in a way that I really haven't seen in a long time. He spends a lot of this story, this issue, working shit out. And I feel like Batman's whole thing is like, actually, I solved that 10 minutes ago. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm reading this. So I would like to actually see how you solved it. And we get that in this comic, which is very cool.
Yeah. Next up, Spider-Verse versus Venom-Verse, number one from Marvel, written by Kyle Higgins and Matt Groom, art by Luciano Vecchio. This is an event that's been led up to for a while. You could probably figure out what's going on here, but a team of five Spider-Men's and five Venom's...
Spider-Men's, as they're known.
That's a technical term. Are forced to fight by two hearts that want to control the universe. Whoever wins, the other ones are obliterated from reality entirely. And most of this book, Spider-Man and Venom are like, oh, we really don't want to fight. We really don't want to do
Can
this.
We not do this can book? Do this? They're sort of like, hey, they're calling their agents being like, can I opt out of this comic book real quick? I have a lot going on.
I was not looking forward to this just because I'm tired of the Spider-Verse stuff in general. Like, there's been good stuff out of it, but... I don't know. I know this is tilting at windmills, but I like it when Spider-Man is a singular character. Like, we're way past...
Way beyond. You like Spider-Man from the 60s?
Something. Like, him being like, boy, I'm really out of my depth rather than like, there's 5,000 more of me, and I'm their leader because I'm the best one. That to me is like, I don't know, that's not Spider-Man anymore. I'm not sure, but...
Oh, no, but you must love it when they're like, the web of life is actually a heart of spiders that
there is. That's the next thing I was going to get to, is there's so much work that Kyle Higgins and Matt Groom have to do in this comic where even the characters like, hold on, I thought there was a web of life. It wasn't null, the whole thing with symbiotes. They're like, yeah, there was that, but we're above that. We're like, we're one level up. And that, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, here's the thing with that, though, is I think that's the red herring of this comic. Mm-hmm. If I can make a prediction, I think that will be revealed to be the actual villain, and the Venoms and Spideys are going to come together to defeat whatever this fake thing is.
For sure. So the thing that I was going to say is, like, there's a lot of work that goes into this in terms of making this valid at all, to the point right. that also there's, like, and Eddie, because Eddie Brock is not Venom right now, they have to be like, yeah, we got the classic Eddie Brock Venom, but it's a different Eddie Brock Venom, so that you can see what you want to see, which is Venom versus Spider-Man, but it's a different guy, so that we can make... So lots of complex stuff going on, but there are, the point that I'm getting around to is Kyle Higgins and Matt Gruber pros at this sort of thing and know how to execute on this, and even though there is a ludicrous amount of groundwork that needs to go into this, you're still getting some fun fights and some fun character moments. And if what you want is Spider-Verse versus Venom-Verse, this book delivers on that.
Well, and like, I think just the title alone is like, hey, do you like complexity? Because that's what this is all about. Like when they reveal, and we read the lead up mm-hmm. issues to this where they selected these characters, just the character selection moment alone is like, hey, I'm Spider-Ham. I'm Recluse. Like, we have to, like, meet these characters for the first time, and it's like, just writing that is hard. Yeah. So these guys are doing great work by writing this with a light touch and getting us into the story in a good way. But I look forward to seeing, like, some of these people being sort of red-shirted mm-hmm. off, I feel like, while also having them come together to fight against whoever is manipulating them into it to begin with.
Let's move from one tournament to another with Exquisite Corpses, number one from Image Comics, written by James Tynion IV, art by Michael Walsh. This is a project with a lot of hype behind it. They have a whole staff of writers and artists who are building out this world of Exquisite Corpses, riffing off of the term Exquisite Corpse, which is usually when you write something, hand it to the next person, they continue it, and it goes around like that. I don't think that's actually how this is working, no. despite the title, but they are spinning it off into a playing card game. They're expecting they're going to have one maxi series here and then potentially more maxi series and spinoffs to go. But this introduces a world where a secret cabal of families have been controlling the world for centuries at this point. Once a year, they take over a small town, have a bunch of killers fight. Whoever is left standing, Hunger Games style, is the one who rules the world at the end. And that killer gets a fun prize at the end as well. So
a fun prize.
This is also like a 68-page book, I want to say, something like that. So it's huge. What do you think about this, Justin?
I mean, this is like, just from a storytelling perspective, this is like a double black diamond task that James Tynion jumps into from a writing perspective, because he introduces the idea that there are 13 families that run America, one from each state, and also a small town featuring other characters who are sort of going to get caught up in this big battle that's coming. And man, that's so many characters to introduce, so many ideas, so many directions, and it works. Like, it's hard, but I was like, oh man, we're gonna get each state coming through here, each of the original 13 colonies being like, hey, here's my fighter with a distinct weapon, a distinct tone, a distinct idea. And all of that, I think, does hang together, and we get to know a couple characters from the town that I'm legitimately worried about. So James Tynion is doing a great job. The Michael Walsh art is excellent. We get these almost trading card moments mm-hmm. for each of the fighters, which is really cool. So, like, it's very complex. I sort of want this to be just a graphic novel or one mm-hmm. volume, because it's such big meals. I'm curious if every issue is going to be this long, or it was more like, let's establish all this and then we get into the bracketing of people fighting each other.
That's my guess. I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that the rest of the issues are normal length. The other thing that I'm curious about, that I should have looked into further but was not immediately clear from either the press releases they sent out or Image Comics site, is given the name, I'd assume that it's like James Tynion and Michael Walsh set it up, and then they pass it on to Pornsack Pichichot and another artist on the second issue, and then somebody takes on the third issue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think that's what's happening. I think they worked with a bunch of people.
yeah,
as a writer's room, but ultimately it's James Todd the Fourth and Michael Walsh that are taking forward, which is fine. They're both great creators, but I feel like it doesn't quite pay off on the title of the book, if that's
well,
true.
But I just think it's like, you don't have to take the title so literally. Like, it's a cool title, even if it's not the, I know, you're like, they said this thing and they're not doing that thing and I'm mad. He's not a Spider-Man always, is he? He's more of a man spider, really.
I guess my point is that it seems set up for that with these 13 different killers in there and the 13 different families, that we would pass it on to somebody else and they would focus on somebody, some other killer as the main character each issue. I don't know if that will happen, but I guess we'll see. Regardless, this is a good setup with some great art. I'm curious to see where this goes next.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I had to sell it, readers on it a little harder, I would call it like Squid Game adjacent, if you're a fan of that Netflix show.
You know what
show
it reminded me of, which is probably the wrong comparison because there's no cars in it, but Twisted Metal a little bit.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
Just, you have all these like arch over the top murderer characters all in the same place, all gunning for each other, so...
Yeah, or like Avengers Arena, if you remember that series back in the day, it definitely has that very bracketed, structured energy to it.
DC versus Vampires, World War V, number 9 from DC Comics, written by Matthew Rosenberg and Shane McCarthy, art by Otto Schmidt and Fabio Veras. In this issue, factions are switching back and forth as the vampires make an alliance with humans. Darkseid is coming after Mr. Miracle and... it's a whole bunch of switch-em-ups and mix-em-ups.
Yeah, I mean, this... you have to know what's happening in this. Yeah. To know what's happening in this. Like, it would be crazy to be like, the first comic I ever read, oh, it was DC versus Vampires or World War V, number 9. That's the one that really hooked me, where I was like, what? Like, there's only a handful of characters who are humans left, Green Arrow and the leader. You've got a bunch of new gods showing up here, like, yo, your world's crazy. Watch out, Darkseid's bad. He's too hard to beat. Then you got Batgirl, Barbara Gordon, just being like, I'm the vampire queen. Like, there's, I mean, just, the biggest indicator is you've got Batman and Alfred hanging out, except Alfred is Green Lantern and Batman is Ra's al Ghul in the bat costume because Bruce Wayne died a long time ago. So,
yeah.
Dead Man is playing a...
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that Mr. Miracle had a baby that now is filled with Dead Man, and so they draw the baby like a little Dead Man who keeps talking to them. So, yes, it's very complicated. I'm not saying this dismissively or negatively at all. My main impression reading this issue was like, I sure hope this is wrapping up quickly, just like this whole world, because like when we had Matthew Rosenberg on the show, he was very much like, yeah, I love doing this, have lots of thoughts, I'm good. And it definitely feels like we need 3 more issues and then the end of DC versus Vampires come to a satisfying conclusion, because this issue is a lot of like, I'm over here, now I'm going over here while you came over here, and we're all kind of missing each other. So it's everybody sort of like jigging around in a circle, and that's fine. That's moving the pieces around the board, but we need to come to a satisfying emotional conclusion, which I feel confident this team could do.
Yeah, well, and like, I know that that maybe sounds negative, but like, it'd be like walking into the last episode of Andor, which is airing right now, and I'm very excited.
What do you think's going to happen?
It's not the right place to talk about it, Alex, but it'd be like jumping into the last episode of season 2 of Andor and being like, I can't wait to get started with this. Like, you have to have watched what's happened before and after to know what's
up. I'll tell you this is not to slag off anybody listening to this podcast that's done this, but one of the things that drives me up the wall is when people are like, yeah, I watched the finale of that. That show seems dumb. And I'm like, you didn't watch anything else. Nothing else that happened.
Person just like drops in on a finale? It's like, I get this.
You're not allowed to judge it. Like, you're allowed to experience it. Like, if you want to experience, like, oh, everybody's watching the Game of Thrones finale and I want to be hanging out with my friends watching it, that's fine. But you can't be like, this makes no sense.
Because what's your life? What are you doing? Yeah. Are you just, like, you adopting, like, a 78-year-old and being like, this is my child, he's 78. It's like, okay, well, what? That's not, you didn't raise this 78-year-old. You didn't, like, you can do that. Do what you want. But, like, that's not your child.
Yeah. Similarly, DC, to what we were saying earlier, if you want to take any of those quotes we just said, like, that's not your child or whatever, throw it on the back, feel free. You have
really permission. Good stuff. But while we're talking about quotes, I love this book. I've loved this arc. This is the best mini-verse in DC, I think. And I, while this is, like, satisfyingly complex for me because I've read every issue, like, I want this to keep going somehow. So, like, I don't know what dark arts we can practice on Matthew Rosenberg to find a way out of this into another series, because this has big finale energy, like you're saying.
Interesting. So, in this scenario, you are DC, you'd like it to continue, and I'm vampires, I'd like to suck the last blood out of it and just be done and move on.
Yeah, you're just sucking blood, and I'm just like, hey, man, you want to suck some more blood? How about this different blood? You want to try some new blood? You want to try this 70-year-old man I adopted's blood? He's my son. I raised him.
Well, why don't we talk about some old blood meeting each other in Godzilla versus X-Men, number one from Marvel, written by Fabian de Souza, art by Emilio Lasso. This is the latest one-shot that jumps forward a decade to the 2000s, I think is what's going on here, as the iconic 97 version of the X-Men fight Godzilla and then, of course, team up with him. You know, Fabian de Souza was writing X-Men then, and I think he really nails that tone.
Well, he goes deep into it. I like the way this made me nostalgic for, like, this very simple version of the X-Men, where they're like, Charles Xavier's good guy, no complication. He's just like, hey, I'll send my X-Men in. They do this wild thing with the super adaptoid, which is awesome. We get some cool fight stuff there. We get to have them team up with our guy Godzilla. There's a message at the end. Like, this is just a nicely composed story that hits the idealizations of all of the characters in it.
Yeah. I will bring back my very light complaint from the previous two issues, though, which is, as much as I like the art in these books, I wish there was more of an effort to make it look like of a piece of the decade, because I think the writers are doing a good job here, but they are pairing them with modern artists who are not necessarily giving us those classic looks from those decades. Like, this needed depending on how you wanted to hit it, but, like, it needed, like, a Rob Liefeld on it or something like that to really
get No.
Not Rob Liefeld, but, like, sort of the exaggerated style of the 2000s here to make it really feel like the book. Mark Silvestri, does that make you feel better? Like,
I mean, that's better, but I wasn't bothered by that.
We get these great pages where, like, we get a title page in every issue where it has Godzilla versus X-Men or whatever ripping out of the pages of an old comic. And I think that's the idea of this project, and that's not exactly the feeling that I'm getting here.
Interesting. Like, I get that. That's a very nitpicky complaint, because I actually thought the art of the fight between Super Adaptoid and Godzilla in this was awesome. Like, it was big. It felt a little bit classic. It felt a little bit more like Silver Age-y, I think, is maybe your complaint. But I didn't mind that it was not quite set there, because the whole thing had the tone from the Fabian's writing of a more classic take on the X-Men, not necessarily what you're saying.
All right. Okay, I guess.
Sorry to take some work out of Rob Liefeld's mouth, but Alex is talking crazy.
I wasn't saying Rob Liefeld. I'm saying, like, a Rob Liefeld, like a Rob Liefeld type.
Oh, not Rob Liefeld, but a Rob Liefeld.
Yes.
Let's just dig down on this. So what is that person? Are you talking about, like, a cousin of Rob's?
What I would do is, like, I go to a comic convention and be like, do any of you know what feet are? And if somebody says yes, I'll move on to the next person until I find Rob Liefeld.
Oh, you're saying, like, knowing feet. is disqualification. A negative.
Yeah,
yes.
For sure.
Nice. Oh, great. Yes, you're the you have a very big non-feet OnlyFans presence, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually running, yes, that, and also I'm running a competition show called America's Next Great Rob Liefeld. The sign-off that I'm working with right now is, I'm sorry, your pouches are empty, and then they have to. Wow. Does that work?
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That, I love that. Oh, it's okay. Nice. It's sort of like Top Chef, but for empty pouches, for un... And let me say, I don't know how many of Rob Liefeld's pouches that he drew had a lot of stuff in them.
Yeah.
They all felt a little empty.
They did. They felt a little, they were floppy pouches back floppy. In the day. Energon Universe 2035, special number one from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, Daniel Warren Johnson, and Robert Kirkman, art by Andrea Milana, Daniel Warren Johnson, and Connor Hughes. This is the free Comic Book Day special, which is now less free this Wednesday. They're charging money Woo! For it. And we're getting three stories. One of G.I. Joe with Transformers, another one of Void Rivals with Transformers, and one of Transformers with Transformers.
Yeah, man. These in a universe named after the juice that powers the Transformers, it's really crazy how the Transformers have taken over.
I have a question for you. So I...
Where's Pete? Is it Where's Pete?
Please, Pete, can you answer any questions about this era? Oh, it felt like a nostalgia bath. I love this. This good. Feels like my really childhood good. Coming back. My adult life, it really hasn't panned out that well, so I'd really love to go back to that younger age, etc. Great cover, wow. No description. So...
Let's clip that.
Here's my question for you, because I think you actually are going to know this answer. I missed this on Free Comic Book Day because no store, and I went to several stores, none of them had this, and it wasn't like it sold out, like it just was not delivered. There was some sort of mix-up with the shipping. It went to some places, so I missed it there, but then I got the press release describing what happened inside from Skybound, and they were like, huge deal, this is the first appearance of characters from Mask, M-A-S-K. And I was like, oh, okay, interesting. Read the book. I would have had no idea that there was a character for Mask in here if I had not read that press release. You know what Mask is, though, right?
I loved Mask when I was a kid. And I didn't read that press release. And it was like, I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
That must be the dude he goes to visit
Tracker
in the first story.
Or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, when I saw Tracker, I was like, oh, Pete's going to love this because he loves Tracker, he loves Clutch, and he loves this Transformer.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Here's the thing, though. They're like, let's have more characters in here that wear masks and ride cars that turn into boats. Like, not necessary. Just a quick note. We're good on stuff happening in the Energon universe. Like, just to read this... The third story, the Void Rivals one, I was like, guys, I'm sorry. I feel like I just found a book at the bottom of a series of paperbacks from the 70s. I was like, what?
Yeah, what and are these like, screaming heads all about?
And they're like, stay tuned. The Quintesson War is coming. I was like, okay. Is it? It's like I wake up one day and I was like, I have to go to a baptism?
I feel, I know I'm being very quibbly about things in this episode, but my issue with this is like we read everything for the Energon universe. I like Skybound. I'm rooting for it. There's been some great stories that have come out of this. Free Comic Book Day to me should be books that you're like, are you interested in this? Here's a jumping on point so you can find out about this thing you might like. I've been reading every issue of Energon Universe, and I don't completely know what was going on here.
Yeah.
Like, and to me, that is a unsuccessful Free Comic Book Day book, down to the Daniel Warren Johnson story where it's like they're forming a band on jazz band on Cybertron, and then he sees jazz.
Well here, like... Yeah, to your point across the board.
And that was jazz, I assume, who likes jazz.
Well, that's my quibble here is like we get a lot of Cybertron back in the day, and a character named Jazz is like, I just found this crazy music from space. It's crazy. You wouldn't believe it. And then he gets to Earth, and the reveal at the end is like he was listening to jazz. I was like, wait, a guy named Jazz? A space robot named Jazz discovered jazz on Earth? What are we doing here? And, like, I liked the story, but I was like, the implications of it, I'm like, guys, you're pointing too hard about how crazy it is that you've turned the nonsense of Transformers and G.I. Joe into a universe.
Yeah.
To have me like, his name is Jazz. He's from another planet, but he loves Jazz. I was like, make Jazz his name when he gets to Earth, after he listens to Jazz, please. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
Yes. In any case, that was free at one point. Yes. Do you have another?
But no, I have some positives to say. Like I like the Daniel R. Johnson story, except for the meta thing of Jazz finds Jazz. The front story is good. I didn't know the maskness of it, but I like what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of the Energon universe, because I don't know it, like Pete knows it, knows all these characters and loves when they say their names. I don't know them as well. So every time I'm like, oh, that reveal isn't working on me.
Mm-hmm.
But just from a pure storytelling perspective, I like it. And the end of that first story I thought was cool. It's the Void Rivals one where I'm like, I don't know what's happening here.
Yeah. Well, which is weird, too, because Void Rivals finally revealed its premise in previous issues. So, like, we finally actually know what's going on in Void Rivals. And then we got to this and I was like, oh, you lost me again. So,
yeah,
we'll see. We'll see. Anyway, Fire and Ice, When Hell Freezes Over, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Joanne Starrer, art by Stephen Byrne. Fire and Ice first switched powers, and then thanks to a relic stolen from Zatanna, have now switched bodies, but not exactly the right way. So they are in the wrong bodies with the wrong powers. There you go. And things go worse and spiral out from there. This is such a weird concept that completely works for me, just because how much it's like, yes, ending the premise of like, let's just go.
Yes.
Let's move forward. Here we go.
I agree with you completely. Like, this is really working and is the spiritual successor to the not necessarily the Justice League era of the Justice League. And like, that's a hard thing to live up to. The whole, like, Keith Giffen and all that stuff was, like, a comedy-forward team that still did stuff. And that was, like, the lead of the DC Universe for a while, which is crazy. But this is doing it. It's doing it in a fun way. There's still stakes to it. There's still, like, real story happening here. And I think it's excellent.
And, you know, I mentioned this with the first issue, but I like the first series, but there was often a lot going on here. I think this has done such a better job of balancing everything that's happening in the book. Like, there's a running bit here where Elrond, the weird little robot, is running for mayor, and they just keep coming back to it in a very fun way.
Just the fact that his name is Elrond is very funny to me.
Yes. So, yeah, it's a great, if you're looking for a great comedy book, definitely pick this up. Thunderbolts, Doomstrike, number 4 from Marvel, written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly, art by Tommaso Bianchi. In this issue, Bucky has been captured by Doom, and Doom just will not feed him the suckling pig that he is tempting him with.
He throws a pig at him. He throws a pig at our guy.
Oh, disgusting. The worst thing that Doom has done all week. Also, meanwhile, Black Widow is building up a team to go and free Bucky from Castle Doomstadt, I believe it's called.
Nice.
Yeah. Thank you. Anyway, you've been loving the series.
You know Latveria, though. You vacation in Latveria.
You love this series. What'd you think about this one?
I do love it. This, to me, is of all of the One World Under Doom books, this is really working. And this feels so Thunderbolts-y in the right way. It's a different take on the idea of Thunderbolts. I talked about this in our Thunderbolts draft, where we drafted different characters to make our own teams of the Thunderbolts. Check it out on our feed. But like, this is the book that feels like Doom is running shit and there's a team that needs to rise up against him. And this is the only team that's actually working as a way of challenging Doom. And that's exciting.
Yeah. And there's big twists here. I think Lansing and Kelly have just nailed the tone of how to write Bucky over various series and miniseries. They just crush it here. There's a great moment with Songbird in this issue as well that I thought was very cool. This is just a cool book. And the thing that I think also they're doing very nicely It is nowhere near the continuity of the MCU, but this is a series that you could hand somebody who came out of Thunderbolts and like it and be like, read this.
Yes.
Check it out. It has some of the same characters. They're in different positions, but you're going to enjoy this next for sure.
Because the vibe is there. The tone is there. Like, it's well written. There's a lot of characters, but we know what's happening all the time. And I just wanted to shout out the rise of the World War II Ghost Rider. Mm-hmm. This character has come out of nowhere and is like everywhere.
Yeah. Right. What now. Was they named the trailer park like Johnson Phillip or something like that? Trailer park after Philip Kennedy Johnson, which I thought was.
Yeah, Johnson and Phillips trailer park. Yes.
Yes, there you go. Very cute.
DC High Volume Batman. The Dark Knight's definitive DC comic stories. Adapted directly for audio for the very first time.
Fear. I have to make them afraid.
He's got a motorcycle. Get after him or I'll have you shot.
You mean blow up the building?
From this moment on, none of you are safe.
New episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Cold Witch, A Tale of the Shrouded College, number one from Image Comics, written by Charles Soule, art by Will Sliney. Per the name, this is continuing the bunch of mini-series following the Tale of the Shrouded, the Shrouded College, a mysterious organization that is battling for control of the world. Each mini-series has a different tone to it. We got Hell to Pay, which is a big heist thing about stealing demon coins. Then we got Vampires in Space One that I'm blanking on the name of right now.
Yes, I'll tell you in 1 second.
Yes.
It is Sun-related Bloody Dozen.
The Bloody Dozen. There we go. And The Cold Witch, interestingly, we don't exactly know the tone of this one yet because this ties pretty heavily back to Hell to Pay, the first miniseries, at least in this issue, as one of the characters who died there, his, I don't know, I want to say girlfriend, paramour, whatever, is looking into what happened with him and this character, the Cold Witch, on the title. So we're just, this is like a prologue issue, if anything, I would say.
Yeah, I like the way, I mean, Charles is building his universe. This is like his thing. And what I, this is a little bit reading into it, but I feel like the lessons he's learned from all of his work in the Star Wars universe, he is putting on display big time in the Shrouded College, where we're dropping in into his stories like in the middle. We're learning about these characters while the action is happening, rather than so many comics, number one issues especially, are like, hey, welcome. Here are some characters, and here's what we call a premise, and we're going to walk you into it. No, this book goes hard, gets you caught up to speed, and just moves into the main story in a way that is really nice. It feels very like, oh, this is episode 4 of this comic, and there's a lot of history here. You don't need to know it to enjoy this, but it's cooler if you do. So that's great. It's really nice to read. He's doing a great job of constructing a larger piece in this series.
Behemoth, number 4 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Grant Spitore and Ryan Angle, art by Jay Martin. This is about a bunch of folks in a bus who are swallowed by a Godzilla-style creature. They have decided they're going to basically give the creature a heart attack, is pretty much their big plan. But they've got a bunch of other smaller creatures inside who are coming after them. I got to say, without starting off too negative, I've generally enjoyed the series and I like the tone.
Yeah.
But this last issue to me felt like they rushed through the ending so quickly, which was a bit of a bummer because I really liked the setup here. I don't know if they needed 6 issues and downsized to 4, exactly what was happening, but it just went quick and I wanted more.
Yeah. I think this should have been 6, especially just the pace of the first 3 was very much like, okay, we're just getting, they're stuck in the stomach of this kaiju. All these characters, they need to figure out how to get out. And in this, they were like, I know how to do it. We'll do this. And then they do it. A bunch of people die all at the same time. And I was like, wait, I don't know. I like that. Okay. And then there's the stuff happens to bring it to a close. And then we land with this, like, and then life went back to normal. And I was like, oh, interesting. I just, like, the big note, like, the big takeaway is, like, oh, I think this needed at least another issue or mm-hmm. two to really feel like they are paying off the really great stuff that was set up in this.
Yeah, and it was a really great setup. The art was very good. I'm glad we read this series, but yeah. I don't know, director's cut it or something like that. The Immortal Thor, number 23 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Jan Basaldúa. Now, we checked out of this title for a while, just no particular reason, just the discussion was getting a little samey, I think.
But, yeah, we booked a room in this title, and then we checked out.
Yeah, exactly.
We had to check out.
Right. And Dunstan, of course, checked in, as we all know.
Yes, as we always say. That guy's on our tails.
Oh, Dunstan, you're a monkey, man. Anyway, I thought it was worth going back to it now that they're going to kill off Thor in several issues' time to see how that's going to happen. In this, Thor is battling a gigantic beast, and there's some twists and turns. What'd you think, Justin? How'd you feel checking back in like Dunstan?
I mean, I think that in this he has to, like, we learn about some weapons. There's a little bit of, like, backstory here. He has to basically put a ring on the nose of this big old bull god, which seems hard. One of my big takeaways from this is, like, it is crazy that Thor works. He flies by just throwing a hammer and then holding on.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't. Like, we need to change that. Like, yeah. Eventually, back in the day, Wonder Woman flew in an invisible jet, and we changed it. Let's just make Thor fly, because he does a lot of flying around here where I'm like, that doesn't make sense.
He's just being dragged around by his hammer.
Yeah, it just feels not quite right.
I felt reading this issue the same as I felt reading previous issues back when we were talking about this more regularly. There's a lot going on here. It's very dense. I like Al Ewing. I think Jed Balzaldúa's art is good, but this is very complicated. So particularly contrasting this with like some of the other work that Al Ewing is doing, like All New Venom, I realize it's a different book, but it's so clean and clear and fun. Yeah. What's going on there. This is like reading Norse mythology. It's very dense and hard to get through.
Yeah, it is a little complicated, and I don't know exactly what the point is. Mm-hmm. It feels like everyone's very stressed. Thor's very stressed, but also is like still pretty casually cool, like I'm going to win this.
Yeah.
So it's hard to tell where our main character's at.
World Tree, number 14 from Image Comics, written by James Tynion IV, art by Fernando Blanco. The previous two issues were giving us the origin of our naked lady who's been killing everybody. Here we jump to the future that we haven't seen in a couple of issues at this point, where the world has been wrecked by the, I want to say, Undernet is what it's called.
Undernet, yep.
Undernet, and find out more about what's going on with that. The series continues to be gorgeously rendered, very terrifying in terms of things that are going on. I expected a little more origin in this issue, but that's all right. Spooky, scary stuff. People turning into dogs, dogs turning into people.
Yeah. Well, I feel like maybe the point of this issue is about it. So most of it is like we're into the future and we're following like one of our last remaining living main characters who's like, man, the internet's killing us. But I made a new internet that is still pretty cool. And like, it's good. Like, I really like that idea because it shows the irresistibility of the internet and the all of it, the dark parts, the light parts, which I think is the underlying idea of this entire series. So that's cool. And I mean, this book is always doing a lot of like, okay, now you know this, so we're going to get to this next thing, which is very like, I think that's a style that James Tynion writes in. It's really nice from an episodic point of view. That's what Department of Truth has been from the jump. And this book is doing that as well, where like it's like, okay, here's some cool stuff. The villains are terrifying. They're always on the edge here coming for our people. But now here's the step forward we're doing. And each step forward, I like. I still don't know what the overall story here, but I'm not bothered that I don't know. It's nice that I don't know.
Mine is a long, Mine is a long, lonesome grave. Number four from Oni Press, written by Justin Jordan, art by Man House. We've been following a man who is trying to stop a curse that was put on him, only to discover at the end of the last issue that the person he thought put the curse on him was actually dead. Find out what happened to her, as well as who actually put the curse on him by the end of this issue. I thought this was really nicely done, with a twist that made a lot of sense from the place that we started in the series. I think overall this is a really well-constructed, surprising, beautifully drawn revenge story that I liked quite a bit.
Yeah, the art, especially this issue, was really well done. Like, it felt like it was all dark. Mm-hmm. Like, it started in the first issue, like, very dark, like, slowly building up. And this issue, I feel like, was all, like, lit. Like, the everything's on fire. And that's what's happening with the characters as well. So it was a really just nice art progression from the first issue to the last. And, yeah, I like the reveals. The Weaver family, you know, they got a lot. That's trouble.
There's a lot going on.
It's a long, lonesome grave.
Mm-hmm. Good series. If you missed it, definitely pick up the individual issues or look forward to whenever the trade comes out. Red Hulk, number four from Marvel, written by Benjamin Percy, art by Jeff Shaw. Here's another character that's rebelling against doom. This time it's Thunderbolt Ross, who is barreling through the snow in nothing but his ripped old pants. There is a moment halfway through this issue, and I know I mentioned with the last issue, like, I was starting to get worried about him getting frostbite or something, which is a major plot point this issue. So yeah. He sees a deer and immediately kills the deer, skins the deer, and creates clothes out of the deer in the snow.
Yeah.
That was surprising.
So, why? I mean, I know you grew up in the suburbs, but where I'm from, that's normal.
That's like a lot of times. Thing to do.
Like, I was like, oh no, it's prom's tonight. So I was like, oh, I could rent a tux or I could hunt, kill, skin, and process deer hide for a full venison tux.
I don't know how long that takes. That's my main thing. And it just feels like, and I know maybe we had a time dash there, so maybe there were a couple of weeks while they tanned and skin the deer and everything.
I don't know if they did much tanning. Sure. I bet he was putting moist deer skin on his body as was his clothing.
Probably.
It was still. Right. And, you know, that's what you do. You know, you're out on the ice planet of Hoth surface. You're going to slice open an animal and crawl in it. You don't have time to process the.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm misremembering this issue. But also, they go into a house that's been mostly abandoned and there's some rotting food there. Is there a rotting pig? Is Doom just leaving pigs all over Latveria?
Yeah, that's really funny. Yes, they walk in and they say, this pig's been rotting for weeks. Doom's throwing pigs.
That's his secret.
But why? Why are you tossing pigs?
Yeah. Maybe he's like, he thinks that's how you play Angry Birds, is like the birds are the angry ones that you toss the pigs at. But you're tossing the birds, Doom.
Yeah, Doom, you're tossing the birds. That's a great point. I think that's definitely the letter you should write into Marvel and be like, hello, Alex Zalbin, journalist. Is this subplot, is there a big subplot for One World Under Doom and perhaps feeding into the Robert Downey Jr. portrayal where he's playing Angry Birds but is playing pigs instead?
I'm gonna put that on Tom Brevoort's newsletter. He loves questions like that.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah.
But to talk about this comic and the non-pig panels, I like this little team. I guess in this One World Under Doom epic, I'm really enjoying the fringes and the edges where actual rebellion is happening. Because in the main titles, the Avengers are just like, yes, we work for Doom now. We hate Doom. And then it's like, we also work for him. So like, that's less fun. While I'm liking, this is a very woolly, almost Suicide Squad style story. And I like that it's working in this very aggressive current state.
Geiger, number 14 from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Gary Frank. In this issue, Geiger and Lady Geiger, which is definitely not her name, come to blows as her plan.
Ashley Arden.
There you go. as her plan is revealed. We check in with all the animals. We check in with the guy with the scar on his face. Lots of stuff going on here. I like this book. I think it is really building out an interesting world here. Yeah, the end.
Nice. You like all the different things that you just said?
Yeah, I like the things I said. I don't know. This is a book that I feel like is very even across the board every issue. There's no issue particularly I'm like, oh, here's the one, here we go. It's not like Redcoat that I think has had some real standout issues. Right. Mostly this is like classic superhero comics. He's like, I can't use my radioactive powers. They're like, you got to use your radioactive powers. He's like, but I can't do it. And that's pretty much what's going on, but it delivers every time out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. Geiger's always sort of losing, and he's always mad. But we get Junkyard Joe in here, who's, like, he's coming, his story's coming to a head. The animals, who have become weirdly, like, equal-footing characters in this universe, where it's like, Two-Headed Wolf and Zebra, what are you up to? I gotta know. So, like, we're getting a little bit of the news in this issue, I think, where we're everything's getting slid forward a bit. The next issue feels like a big one.
Yeah.
From a nuclear bomb perspective.
Well, I'd say that's Past Time. And coincidentally, we're going to talk about Past Time number 2 from Mad Cave Studios, written by Joe Harris, art by Russell Olson. This is a story of baseball and a vampire that just wants to play baseball. That's what's going on with him. I gotta say about this book, I really like the premise of this book, that there is this vampire that just really wants to play baseball, but also keeps killing people while he's doing it. I think the storytelling is interesting, but, and maybe this is just a function of the amount of comics we read, but I felt like we ended the last issue with, like, and that vampire is going to play baseball. And when we pick up here, he's like, I just want to play baseball. Just give me a chance to play baseball. I'm like, did I dream the last issue? What happened here?
Yeah. It's a little complicated, all the moves to get this vampire to play baseball. And it feels like there's a lot of corpses at points in this, and they're being stuffed away in a almost sitcom-y way. It feels a little bit like if Larry David was a vampire who wanted to play baseball, where he's like, oh man, these corpses keep getting in the way of my baseball. I'm getting foisted out of playing baseball. And like I like the, like you're saying, I like the central premise here, and I wonder if we can get to that a little. This issue just felt a little bit businessy, maybe.
Yeah. I Was a Fashion School Serial Killer number 2 from Image Comics, written by Doug Wagner, art by Daniel Hilliard. The concept is right there in the title. Except we have a main character who has a compulsion to kill and then turn her victims into clothing and other accessories. But at the same time, she's finally learning how to make some friends. I love the tone of this book. I was a little worried. I mentioned this on the live show, but this team, which I really like, I like the art, I like the weird, wild swings they're taking with their books, has a tendency to like do a banger of a first issue, and by issue 2, it's like a deflating balloon, where it's like, we blew up the balloon, and now it's going over here, and you don't know where it's going. Which is okay. Again, they're like taking chances, but the first issue was so strong, I was worried about the second issue. I think they knocked it out of the park. This stays the course. It's emotionally interesting. It's fun. It's crazy dark and violent. But like you were talking about getting rid of bodies, there's a great panel here where she just has like a skinned corpse that's kind of hanging out of the closet, and somebody comes over and she's like, got to stuff that in there. Very fun.
And a skinned corpse is going to stink. The skin is like a trash bag on the body. Keeps the smells in. Skinned corpse is going to stink a lot.
Totally.
If I may, that's why when I go to my my garbage bagologist, dermatologist, I'm like, fix my stink protector, would you?
What do they say?
They're like, get out of here. I'm a professional. I'm a doctor. But I agree with you. This is really good. Like, it's... It keeps the tone where with, like, our main character is a, like, ice-cold murderer. But we're riding along with her the entire time and are like, yeah, you got to kill again, otherwise you're going to be scratching. And I hate an itch. Mm-hmm. I hate an itch. So, like, it's good. Like, I like the series of kills we get here are really good. The art matches the tone in a good way. I'm fully on board.
The Uncanny X-Men, number 14 for Marvel, written by Gail Simone, art by David Marquez. We've got a bunch of trains running here. Back in the day, we are following a mutant who is dealing with some real prejudice. Then in the present, we got our kids are going into a spooky dark cave, and the adults are mostly not wearing clothes, and Gambit is hanging out with a dragon.
Yes, Wolverine pops out of bed in some fresh jorts in this issue that I was like, bro, are you sleeping in jorts?
Yeah, that's hot.
That's uncomfortable.
He chased.
Man, that's changing. Sure, maybe his healing factor is fine with like a real sweaty undercarriage, but that's no way to sleep, my guy.
Yeah, there
that's
is
no way to sleep.
There
bub.
Is a 0% chance that he isn't freeballing it to bed. I know he is. He's sleeping.
Oh, yeah. You're not wearing jorts and underwear to sleep in? Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I'm saying, like, Wolverine, I think canonically he wears jorts to bed, as we know. But in my head canon, he is 100% sleeping in the nude because he is too hairy and too warm to do anything else.
Oh, you're saying that in your head canon, which is, like, your imagination, yes, is what we're saying, yeah, is that Wolverine is nude always, and he just slides on some jorts when he has to see people.
Yeah, I think so. Do you think he's putting on like a onesie or something to go to sleep?
He's like, no, I think he sleeps in the jorts.
He is
literally commented on, like, hey guys, put some clothes on. Don't just run out of bed and fight stuff. Is literally said.
Yeah, that's true.
So I just think the way his shorts look, I'm looking at him right now. These are wrinkled. Like, he's not throwing them out.
All right.
I think he sleeps in these.
Do you think his bed sheets are also denim? Because I do.
Yeah, this guy likes to be wrapped in denim. I mean, he's Canadian. Yeah. He's all denim all day.
All denim.
He's got
not
denim
flannel?
Pillowcase.
Not flannel?
No. No, denim. Canadian tuxedo. That's what it's called. So he's fully really? Like denim, denim bed sheets, denim curtains, shower curtains, denim. This guy's all denim.
Oh, my God. Denim carpet.
Yeah.
One of his favorite
jokes. He's got
jokes
Levi's
like,
501 carpet.
Yeah. People are always to Wolverine. They're like, does the denim carpet match the denim drapes?
And they do. Yeah, this guy's got denim pubes. That's how Canadian he is. That dude's Canadian. We're joking a lot, but I actually think this is my favorite arc for this series in a while. Like, it's still weird and woolly. Like, we have our core young mutants facing off against this mystery that is the flashbacks we're getting in this, which are really good, really well done, super detail-oriented, both in the writing and the art. Really cool. And then we're getting Gambit just hanging out with a dragon, which is weird. Mm-hmm. That's weird in this story, but it's also working. It's just funny because, and I think we're about to do a State of X podcast where we're going to break down what is happening in the X universe. And a little spoiler for my takeaway, this book is Uncanny X-Men, but it feels like Excalibur. This feels like a modern, it's a tonally an Excalibur book where it's mixing magic, mutant-dom, and weirder mythical storytelling in the middle of this very specific X-Men team. And I very much like it, but it's funny to me that tonally just feels very different than what I expected.
Yeah. Phantom Road, number 12 from Image Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Gabriel H. Walta. In this arc, we are finding out exactly what's been going on the Phantom Road, and there are some big answers in this issue, kind of, but we find out what's going on with the weird angel egg. We find out what is up with the strange mud golems that have been wandering the road, and even find out about the Billy Bears, the roadside diners, and what their purpose is in this world. Justin, I know you were excited to get some mythological answers in this title. What did you think? Ooh, you are on mute. Yeah.
I love this title.
Oh, there we go.
Just a quick mute.
Yeah,
what was I doing?
Screaming.
You'll never know.
You were screaming. Enjoy.
I was screaming into my mid-stack pillow. I do my mid-stack scream, and you never hear about it until now. What am I screaming about? I'll never tell. I love this comic, and I love this arc specifically. This series spent 10 issues setting up a lot of mystical, mysterious circumstances. Great characters, but just like, what is this? What is this cross-dimensional thing happening? Who are these people? This arc, the last issue in this one, is telling us the story, giving us the background in a very Twin Peaks way, which is, I love Twin Peaks. I love that this is solidifying around that tone in the way they're telling the story. I think, like, doing a David Lynch type story is hard, and I think that Jeff and Gabriel Walta are doing a great job of hitting that without it feeling like a ripoff or even an homage. It just is like striking this tone of a great mystery that has very straight-laced people encountering deep mysticism.
Great stuff. Next up, Transformers number 20 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Daniel Warren Johnson, art by Jorge Corona. In this issue, Megatron is back. He's coming directly for Starscream, among other things. Again, wish Pete was here to talk about this.
Yeah, he would be really excited about this.
He'd be very excited. I, on the other hand, find it a little silly that Megatron was like, fix Starscream. Now I'm going to kick the shit out of him. Now I'm going to make him pick me up as a gun and shoot this other Transformer.
Now I feel especially weird that we are reviewing this, because the idea that Megatron is like, all right, you loser, pick me up because I'm a little gun now. So you got to pick me up and pull the trigger. And then all the other bad guys are like, hey, he's too weak. He's a little gun. And even then, he's still too weak. Do you have to shoot him again? And then Starscream's like, okay. And he just keeps pulling the trigger. I'm like, why is this?
Yeah.
And this is this because that's what happened in.
But you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. Nobody is making you justify that Megatron was a tiny little gun. I don't know. I like the Starscream Megatron relationship, and I always have. I think the dynamic there is interesting, and that plays out well in this issue. But whatever we're leading up to with Megatron versus Optimus Prime, an event that we've seen 1 billion times, but it is always satisfying, I'm looking forward to getting there.
Yeah, and on the other side, Optimus Prime, like, we do get some nice conversations mm-hmm. about what the spark is and all of that, and that's cool. And Optimus is like, yeah, I've been feeling a lot of emotions, rage. I'm very mad all the time. And I'm like, whoa, they're really boiling this pot mm-hmm. of Optimus Prime. While at the same time, we're getting the Decepticons truly just fucking around. And that's wild. And then we get this whole scene. And again, I wish Pete was here to talk about this, where they're like, hey, we made some new Autobots. They're all the airplanes. And the human's like, sick, airplanes.
My favorite part of that, which also I don't know anything about this, is like, well, they're very tiny, but they're very sweet.
Yes, they all give them they're a tiny hug. Airplanes. Yeah, and they all are similar looking. There's Air Raid, Fireflight, Skydive, and Slingshot.
Yes.
And
one of my favorite things with these Energon books is reading the first paragraph of the letters page, where invariably they're like, wow, can you believe it? Cooler is finally here in the book. That character that you love. I'm freaking out right now. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know who this is. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and just an editor's note, when we send this to the Energon fans, just delete this whole review. 100%. I would say this is not what they want.
Yeah, and by the way, sure. I do want to say, like, and this is going to come out sounding kind of negative, but I mean this positively. While I was looking for information on the Energon Universe Free Comic Book Day special, I stumbled on this podcast that was talking about just that issue for well over 2 hours. And, like, that blew my mind. It blew my mind because it was, I mean, it also blew my mind after reading it. I was like, how did you talk about this for 2 hours? But they are super fans of this, and they clearly find enough to dig out. The same way that we, if we really pushed ourselves, probably could talk about, like, I don't know, an X-Men comic or something like that. Like,
yeah,
maybe. Maybe we could stretch that.
Definitely.
Better. Yeah, some of them.
We could get into it.
Yeah, we can get into it.
Talk my about point is Nightcrawler's that, like, Christianity and the swashbuckler.
Whatever we say about it, if you are a fan of this thing and you are loving this thing and it does feel like it's putting you through a nostalgia bath or whatever, I think that's great. And that means there's a place and worth for this thing, even though it is not quite working for me personally.
Well, and I'm happy to read this. I like reading it. My point is, no matter how much you love this canon, it's still funny that the big bad guy turns into a tiny little gun that he has to be like, shoot me, Starscream. You have to pull my little trigger.
I can't do it.
That's funny.
Yes.
No matter how you slice it. So I'm here for it. I can't wait till he gets an even tinier gun or like a little special nozzle on his tiny gun.
I mean, I think legitimately what's actually going to happen is he's going to rip that arm cannon off of Optimus Prime, which is going to cure Optimus Prime of his anger. But then Megatron is going to turn into a tank instead of a gun, and we'll... God.
Well, it's also funny in this issue, like, they're like, oh, man, you are much cooler as a tank. He's like, but I'm not a tank. I'm a tiny gun. and he's, like, happy to be a tiny gun. I was like, okay.
X-Factor number 10 from Marvel, written by Mark Russell, art by Bob Quinn. This is the final issue of this series as the team quits being X-Factor and goes off to do their own things. We love Mark Russell. I think we generally like the art in this series, but have been sort of back and forth about it as a whole. What did you think about the wrap-up here?
I'm sad to see this go, because I do like this comic, and this does seem to be the most direct spiritual successor of these X titles. X-Factor in the past had this sort of, like, characters who don't quite match, talking about why they don't match, and still going on missions. And so I will miss this from the X canon right now because it's cool. And I want to shout out the panel, which is like one of the last pages, maybe page like 18, 19, of Havoc catching Polaris after he releases her. Her energy's crackling all around. There's like soldiers that she's sort of levitating all around them. And it's a great romantic moment between the two of them. Maybe my favorite page of the week. Really well done. And I think this series touched on some great emotions with these characters. It was still comedy forward. I'm sad to see this go. I enjoyed this.
This never quite came together as a series for me, but I did really enjoy a lot of moments here. I mean, there was the whole corn dogging bit where there was the boss of the team always had a corn dog and he was on a corn dog diet. Very funny.
And we've established that as corn dogging.
Yes, exactly.
And something we do.
Yeah, I do it to lose weight. The final issue here also had a really fun bit about Pyro going back to writing romance novels and then it all getting destroyed.
Let me be honest, it was a trigger when he was finishing his romance novel and his computer got electrified and he lost it all. I was like, oof.
Yes.
Don't like that.
Funny bit, I thought, though. And so, yeah, when this title worked, it worked. Last but not least, let's talk about Golden Rage, Mother Knows Best, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Chrissy Williams, art by Lauren Knight. This takes place on a island where a bunch of menopausal women have been said to die, as well as a younger woman who is also menopausal. The twist in the first issue of the sequel miniseries is that a baby shows up at the island. And what are they going to do about that? Go crazy.
Yeah, the baby is upsetting their lives, just like iconic movie from the 90s, Three Men and a Baby.
Yes, pretty much the same thing. This is a book that I have a little bit of a hard time holding on to the tone of. I think there's some really good action in here, and I want to like this concept, which feels very much next door to Bitch Planet, the Kelly Sue DeConnick title.
Yeah.
But But I don't know. It feels like it avoids the concept sometimes. Like it avoids the idea of these old women who have been banished here. It avoids the killing of each other, mostly in the first series. But we start to get back to that. Oops. We start to get back to that here, which I liked. So I don't know. We'll see where it goes.
The back third of this book, I thought, is where it really came to life, when it's like, oh, this baby. Well, there's a power struggle here from our main characters of, like, who's in charge. And then the baby becomes, like, the conch, essentially, where it's like, well, I have the baby, so, like, that's what's happening. And that's a cool, active idea, and we get some nice stuff in the back half, the back third of this, action-wise and pushing the narrative-wise. It's a shame Pete's not here because he loves an older woman.
Absolutely. Maybe that's where he is. That is it for the stack.
He's having his own golden rage.
Yes. And that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts, we do patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comics, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Dormammu, I am your Mamamoo.
Join Alex, Justin, and Tony. Every Tuesday night, yeah, once a week, they'll blow your mind.